Good morning, everybody. excuse me. I'd like to thank Tom and the other organizers for inviting us here to talk about this topic, which is of great interest and ongoing involvement for a number of us. So what I'm briefly going to try to cover today are talk about reasons to share data and the technology resources that are available for it. Then I want to just mention the cultural issues that other speakers like Carol and Stephanie will go into in more detail. And then I'll summarize what the responses of the Ecological Society of America have been in recent years to the demands of open data. And then finally, I'm going to describe a framework for ethical guidelines for data reuse that John Porter from the University of Virginia and I developed and wrote up as participants in the Data One project, which is where Stephanie and Carol and I have also worked at various times. So, briefly, the reasons for sharing data come in part from what's been described as the data deluge. And what's happening in many fields of science, certainly including the life sciences, ecological sciences, and I think in your fields, are that there is just enormously increased capabilities to gather, store, access, and share data. So we're getting the opportunity to do this. What do we do about it? What benefits might there be from it? How can the science be advanced in behalf of it? And so related to that are opportunities to use and analyze multiple data sets, including those not originated by the user. You can sit at your computer, and for many of us, get access to hundreds, if not more, data sets around the world. Related to our own research, which gives us an ability to ask new kinds of questions and develop new hypotheses and new experiments. So what are the benefits of sharing data? For one thing up front, and the main premise of this talk, is data sharing has always seemed to me to be a basic ethical principle in science. But it does have, beyond its ethical aspects, direct benefits. For example, replication, the ability to replicate analyses, is a fundamental element of the scientific process. But for a lot of environmental data, replication is possible if you get access to the original data for the analysis. A lot of environmental data are one-time things, right? With respect to human rights, Article 15 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, which is one of the many UN declarations, dictates that people worldwide have the right to the benefits of scientific progress. They are to enjoy the benefits of the scientific progress and its applications. And the failure to share data, I would argue, restricts that right. If you don't have access to the data, you don't have direct access to the benefits, as Tom was mentioning about, for example, medical data. Respect to data preservation, data that are not archived can be lost as a result of computer failures, software obsolescence, or simple neglect. And I've also posted up here a famous data decay curve made famous by Bill Michener et al. Nearly 20 years ago, showing the loss of information content over time, from time of publication, specific details get lost, general details get lost, accidents happen. A computer fails, or when I was a graduate student at a marine laboratory, a laboratory burned down, causing one professor to lose many years' worth of genetic data. People retire, they change careers, they don't preserve their data. And finally, of course, we and data are mortal. Another aspect of benefit of sharing data is that the scientific community as a whole, as mentioned, benefits from the ability to share data sets. Sharing data can feed into issues of data integrity. Multiple users can make it more possible that some sort of deficiencies will come to light. And finally, the basic issue of public trust. In the face of controversy, if you're willing to get your data out there, you have a better chance of increasing public trust in the results of scientific research. And I'll mention that in a couple of points that Dave Schimmel made when I present his notes in a few minutes. So it's been argued by a number of folks, and certainly Stephanie probably can speak to this in more detail than I can, that in many fields, at least, we partly solved the technology issue. We have resources for data sharing out there. And I'll cite a few of those that are available in ecology and environmental sciences, and then a few that I found more or less by Google searching for your fields. Data One, the Data Observation Network for Earth, which Bill Michener talked about in his talk here on Monday morning, is a important resource for data sharing, data analysis, writing data management plans, a whole variety of activities related to that in the life sciences. The National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at University of California, Santa Barbara, where Stephanie was formerly deputy director, has been an enormously important source of means of analyses of new data sets, storage of them, and technology for data sharing. Dryad, data bank, which is housed at the University of North Carolina, provides storage for data of all kinds in the life sciences and provides means of attaching digital object identifiers, so-called DOIs, which are permanent links for data sets so that they can be readily cited in the literature. GenBank, of course, is the home of genetic data in the United States at the National Institutes of Health. And as I say, just a few things that I just wandered around on Google a little bit that I noticed in the soil sciences, from the World Data Center for Soils, the Landcare Research Soils Database, which is in New Zealand, USDA Web Soil Survey, and you'll hear about Robert Norton's work in a few minutes in this session. So let me put aside things here. So just to mention cultural obstacles along the way, which Carol will get into in more detail. There's fear of data misuse or lack of use. People are either concerned that their data will be misinterpreted, or as Jim Richmond, the former director of NCES, famously noted, people are afraid they'll put their data out there and nobody will want it. Loss of competitive advantages and benefits. People don't want to get scooped on next paper that they base on a data set. Related to that, loss of personal ownership. Lack of reward system. Certainly in the academic world, people are rewarded for publications in high impact journals. And sharing data isn't necessarily part of the culture. It's not necessarily part of the reward system for advancement. Technology has been cumbersome in the past. I think we can argue that it's getting better and more available. Lack of training, certainly, in just the mechanisms of sharing data and finding the sites to archive them. Sensitive data issues, things, certainly environmental sciences, things like threatened endangered species locations. I think probably in agriculture there may be issues about proprietary data. It's certainly reflected in the private sector a lot. And then finally, a lack of standard data management practices. So what have the responses of the Ecological Society of America been to the growth of interest in open data? First, about 10 years ago, I had the opportunity to, with National Science Foundation support, chair something called the Society Summit, which brought together about a dozen professional societies to explore issues of data sharing and open data. And they developed, at the time, a vision as members of the scientific community to promote the advancement of science through the process of documenting, archiving, and making available the research information and supporting data of published studies. We were able to follow that with an additional grant to develop an additional four workshops between 2006 and 2009 where we explored a number of specific topics. Development of data registries, which are basically databases of databases where you can share metadata without sharing the data itself themselves. The needs for data centers for the life sciences, the actual archives to store the data. Cultural obstacles to data sharing. We spent a couple of days exploring those in detail, particularly trying to think about ways to overcome those obstacles. And then finally, we had a discussion of incentives for data sharing. How can we change that incentive structure in academia and elsewhere? How can we reward scientists properly for sharing not just their publication and the analyses, but the raw data themselves? Finally, that led to a requirement for sharing of data, supporting publications in two of ESA's six journals, Ecological Applications and Ecological Monographs. And I'll describe that in more detail when I work through Dave Schimmel's talk shortly. A lot of professional societies have been involved, along with 33 other organizations. I should say the tri-societies have not been part of that, but I hope perhaps that will change in the future. But we did have a wide range of organizations involved, from general biology sciences to conservation to zoology to evolution and so forth, involved in these efforts to date. So what's missing from this discussion? Well, Patricia Serrano et al. In a recent article in Bioscience highlighted the issue very well. We've covered the technology for data sharing aspects pretty well. Those resources are coming online. As I mentioned, we've got had a lot of discussion about rewards and incentives for data sharing, but the ethical discussion is still not fully developed. What is the core ethical values about data sharing? And I've added the emphasis here with that circle. That's not part of the original diagram. Serrano et al. Pushed the idea that we still need to have a broader discussion of ethics, particularly within our professional societies. Nature editorial about a year and a half ago put it in the context of etiquette, that research communities need to agree on a standard etiquette for data sharing. But again, we don't have the guidelines for that out there. The professional societies don't have those kinds of guidelines. The journals in general do not have it. Nature pointed out that there are something like 600 subject-specific repositories, all with community-specific standards. Granted, across a wide range of disciplines, but for any individual researcher, that's a serious challenge. Where do I go? How do I decide? So the objective of the rest of this talk is to summarize, as I say, a piece of work that John Porter and I did and published in Bioscience a couple of years ago under the auspices of the Data One Project, which is to put out for argument, we're not offering a definitive, complete solution, but to offer some ethical guidelines for consideration by the scientific community. So first we explore the obligations. What are the obligations of data generators, the people who initiate and put out their data? First, data generators ought to provide data supporting publications in a timely fashion. That is, I would hope that ESA will do this for more of its journals and other journals will do that more widely, to require connecting publications with the data that support them. Related to that is to ensure the accuracy and clarity of the associated metadata. Metadata are the things that describe the data set, so you need to have clear labels for what you've measured, clear explanations of units, things like that, and to make sure that they're accurate and complete. And then finally, not placing unreasonable constraints on the use of data. Ideally, we'd like to have a completely open data universe where there are no constraints at all, but at the very least, not unreasonable constraints on the use of data, particularly when they're put in a public archive. So what are the reciprocal obligations of data users? First and foremost among those is attribution. We need to give people credit for data if they're willing to put it out there and to push against what has been a long-term sort of embedded thing in our culture to keep the raw data to ourselves. So the first and most common, the longest lasting attribution, of course, is just simple acknowledgement. People put in their long list of acknowledgments at the end of a paper. We thank the organization for financial support. We thank Joe and Sally for miscellaneous reviews, etc. But preferable to that is some form of formal citation. Ideally, digital object identifiers, so-called DOIs, which you may be familiar with. They're attached to any peer-reviewed paper, I think, these days that you publish. But we can also attach them to data sets through Dryad and through other organizations who will provide them. But it's not always possible. They're not always available. There are a number of efforts underway through organizations like DataCight and the Research Data Alliance to come up with multiple models for data citation in order to, again, make it possible to spread credit for data. And then finally, there's just the limitations of the citation process, which anybody has to cope with. But again, key is attribution. As Serrano in another article in this year in the open access journal GigaScience noted, talking about the need to answer synthetic and integrated research questions, and they cite, I added the emphasis here, the need to receive proper attribution of their important contributions. That's what it is key to encouraging people to make data sets available, we believe. So what are the obligations of data users in more detail? One aspect that John and I explored is the issue of co-authorship. When might co-authorship be appropriate? And we suggested several criteria. One is shared data that are integral to the manuscript. That is to say, how integral a particular data set is to a manuscript can be a function of what other data sources are used in the research. And I'll describe a few examples momentarily. If all the data in the manuscript come from a single source, a strong case can be made for co-authorship. Co-authorship might also be more appropriate if the data have unique or novel characteristics, being based on the methodology that they're collected, the sampling design, spatial and temporal extent, or the level of integration. And then thirdly, of course, for any authorship guidelines, is the availability and the willingness of the potential co-author to participate and to take responsibility for the final product. So this diagram illustrates common criteria for authorship, with data acquisition highlighted in the lower left corner, because the other four here are very common in the life sciences and in ecology. Data acquisition is not that common. It is in the medical field, but less so in the environmental field as a criterion for authorship. And I don't know how these crosswalk to the criteria in soil and agricultural sciences. But this illustrates the general existing criteria for authorship, particularly in life sciences. And then we also came up with a four-legged stool, if you will, for criteria for authorship by a data provider. Again, are the data integral to the analysis? Are the data novel or unique? Is the provider willing to share authorship? And is the provider able to participate? And we suggest that with respect to co-authorship, that these four are all essential to the process. So a couple of examples I will put up from the paper. First of all, a data provider has collected high-resolution data on locations of small mammals over an extended period. Data are made available in a public repository. Another researcher downloads the data and applies spatial statistics to characterize social dynamics of a species. Should the researcher contact the data provider regarding authorship? We suggest that, in this case, the data are essential to the success of this manuscript. It's one data set that you are reinterpreting or adding a new interpretation to, primarily because of the novel characteristics. And you can make a strong case that data providers ought to be offered an opportunity to collaborate in some way on the manuscript. However, and we emphasize this throughout this argument, if the data providers don't want to participate, the researcher should still be free to go forward with the new paper. That, again, ideally we don't want restrictions to be placed on data when they're in public archives, as long as the data are cited or acknowledged in some fashion. Somewhat different example, the researcher identifies data on nutrient levels from three streams, might be more appropriate to some folks in this audience, and uses them to test hypotheses regarding the seasonality of nutrient loading. The data are from three sources: a graduate student, a senior professor who is now passed on, and a government agency. How do we think about co-authorship in these terms? Well, it's a little bit harder than the first example, because the researcher needs to decide if the paper would be publishable with, say, only two or even one of the data sets, needs to think about the novel characteristics of the data, and so forth. But a few thoughts here. The graduate student seems like a pretty clear target for potential co-authorship. The person is alive and willing, able to contribute. Obviously, the professor is not in a position to contribute. And government agencies don't typically get listed as authors. And so here is a somewhat more complex case to think through. Finally, a third example where a researcher develops a model for predicting storm movement and tests using meteorological data from 250 different stations. Each one's operated independently. Is there a need for co-authorship here? We would say certainly not. None of these data are likely truly integral to the analysis in the sense that one or more is going to completely shift the results, although one would want to do sensitivity analysis to determine that. Meteorological data are relatively standardized. There's probably nothing particularly novel about the way they were obtained, and most journals do not want authorships of 250 plus authors, although that's getting to be the case somewhat in physics and in molecular biology, some areas like that. However, once again, the data sources ought to be cited and acknowledged in some way formally in the text. So based on these discussions, we offered some proposed ethical principles for consideration by the scientific community at large. First of all, publishers should revise authorship guidelines to address the contribution of data providers. There ought to be a way to clearly acknowledge their role in the process. And we suggest that professional society ought to formally incorporate consideration of data reuse into our codes of ethics. Data generators, as I said before, should make public the data underlying their publications in a timely fashion and make sure that the associated metadata are accurate so that the data can be clearly interpreted. Conditions for the use of data should never include restrictions that limit the range of scientific conclusions that can be reached. If you're going to put your data out there, you have to accept the possibility that somebody will reach different conclusions than you will have, hopefully augmenting them, but it's possible that they will simply disagree with you. That's the way science works. Data users have an obligation to cite the data users. Again, getting it back to that attribution process. We want to make sure that the data users get credit. We suggest the co-authorship ought to be provided to data providers if the data are integral to the manuscript and if the data providers can meet other conditions of authorship that are traditionally required in the life sciences. If the data provider declines to accept co-authorships, the use of the data publication should proceed in any case. And then finally, re-emphasizing, sharing data is an ethical obligation for scientists because the timely sharing of scientific data benefits both science and society. The key here is trust. Establishing the links between the data users and the providers, certainly whenever that's individual scientists or groups of scientists, less so large organizations, but to establish a trust. Roach et al. In an article in PLOS Biology a year and a half ago, again emphasized this etiquette of communication and recommended encouraging communication between data collectors and users up front. They suggested that this could reduce duplication of effort, reduce risks of outright misinterpretations of data. There's a difference between scientific disagreement and not understanding something in a data set that because you didn't originate it, and facilitating collaboration in the scientific community. They also recommended full disclosure, again, of the ethics of data reuse, requiring disclosure of reuse details about what's happening with it. And they suggested, which not everybody agrees with, the possibility of allowing data collectors to review the papers associated with that. What's the path forward here? Again, data sharing is a benefit. We need to incorporate standards for data sharing and reuse in professional codes of ethics. And to borrow again from a Nature editorial, before you can climb the highest mountains, you need proper safeguards and a decent map. And I thank you. We have time for questions.
Yeah, time for questions.
Okay.
But there are more ethical principles than just obligations.
Mm-hmm.
Have you deliberately left those out, or did you not see a way to bring them into this discussion?
Can you expand on that? I don't know if I fully understand.
Well, for example, we have obligations towards others or entities with ethical standing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
So, I'm not an ethicist, so I'm not able to put this 100% clearly, but I know that these arguments exist. In fact, there's lots of them. So, have you left these out deliberately, or have you not seen a way of working them into this?
Offhand, I would say it's simply not been our particular area of focus. But I fully acknowledge that it's an important point. And that is one reason why we tried, and we might have made a stronger case, that the ethics for data sharing are very much two-way. That, yes, we believe, my original belief in the ethics of data sharing comes from the fact that we're all obliged to clearly disclose the methods in our papers, right, as to how we got where we go. And I simply link, in my mind, that along with that is to make the associated data available, at least that directly associated with publication. There's a different argument to be had about making open data available from the beginning. There's something called the open science movement that is beginning, where people are sharing data even as it's originated in the laboratory. I think that is an interesting area of practice. I don't know if it's necessarily an ethical concern there, but when it comes to the issue of when you publicize an analysis, I think that's where the ethics, to me, initially kick in. But I agree, it's more complicated than that. The other ethical side to it is that I come from is because I'm active in something called the AAAS Science and Human Rights Coalition, which is organized by the American Association for the Advancement of Science. which works, among other things, to promote the human rights of scientists and also to talk about the links between science and human rights. And with respect to this issue of people's, quote, right to the benefits of scientific progress, I think at least in part that is a right to the benefits, a right to access to the literature, access to the data underlying that. If you live in a developing country and somebody is gaining personally from data collected in your country, whether it's about environmental issues or medical issues, I think that there is a case to be made that those people have a basic human right to access that. Other questions?
Let's say the data user has reached a different conclusion than the data owners.
Yep.
From the data owner's point of view, that conclusion or methodology is clearly wrong. What should they do? What can they do?
Reply in the literature. To me, that ought to become part of the scientific debate. It might be a little bit easier to think in a different way. It's starting to be available in the environmental sciences. It's long been available, I think, in the social sciences that, in economics, that the databases used are not necessarily generated by individuals. Okay, but economic databases. The United States has enormous economic databases that are generated by government agencies, and anybody can interpret them. And so there can be very lively debates back and forth about the interpretation of the same database. I think that we in the life sciences ought to encourage exactly that kind of behavior. I don't know if that answers your question.
Normally, they do not get into that debate. That's why you might review that, whatever manuscript.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you have to wait until they publish that. Then you find out, hey, they used my data this way.
Yeah.
What?
Well, one way around that would be to do what Roach et al. Has suggested, which some of my colleagues have doubts about, but is an opportunity, which is they suggest inviting the data generators to actually review the manuscript in question. And that would be one way to do that. I'm going to describe myself as neutral on that question, but I think it's an interesting argument. Other comments?
The issue is so complex that I think there is a need for many groups or many steps to be involved in the solution. So my question is, what is the role of the funds providers in the sense that should they put forward an obligation to make the data available after a certain amount of time? Otherwise, a certain amount of funding would be retained or somehow...
That's happening.
Nicholas, you want to repeat the question?
Sure, I'm sorry. Yeah. The gentleman asked, what is the role of funders in making data available? And I would say that that's actually happening in a number of cases here in the U.S. The National Science Foundation requires data management plans, which don't necessarily require data archiving, but certainly I think the Obama administration is moving in that direction. National Institutes of Health does that. In the UK, I understand the Wellcome Trust is now requiring public archiving of data that they fund, and I can't remember who it is, but there's a large foundation in the U.S. that is doing the same thing, certainly particularly in medical areas, but that's spreading. So certainly in the U.S. and in the U.K., I'm less familiar with funding mechanisms elsewhere in the world, that's starting to happen. Right. Yeah. And in other talks that I and other people have given, basically, along with convincing the scientific community of this, the two levers that have been pointed out are the funders and the publishers. The publishers are the gatekeepers of the literature, as it were, and of course the funders make the research possible. Other comments before I try to become Dave Schimmel? Back. Yeah, that is all from a 2013 paper in Bioscience that John Porter and I wrote. And if you catch me after the talk, I'll give you a card so you can find it. But
how about not only the data, but the models or methods that are associated with that paper? For example, recently many models are actually a piece of computer program to code. And well, they cannot be really described in the paper itself.
Right.
Many people want to access this code, but it's not even readily available oftentimes in
I have not gotten into that, but a lot of people are advocating exactly that, to publish algorithms and code, again, particularly when it's directly linked to publication. I'm not directly familiar with any examples of where journals and publishers, or journals and funders, excuse me, are requiring that, but it has been a pretty widespread topic of discussion, data sharing that I'm familiar with. I don't know if Stephanie or Carol know of any examples of that, but... But it's definitely a topic that's out there. Okay.
What could be the role of librarians in helping in the process?
I will mention that in Dave's talk, but again, I'm less familiar with organizations outside the country. In the U.S., a lot of university libraries are starting to be the data archive of choice, or at least of opportunity, for researchers in the U.S. They're increasingly taking on that role, so that the libraries not only become the place where you go for the journals, but it also becomes the place where you can archive your data. And I think the American Library Association has had some meetings on that topic, and there are some at least fairly strong pilot projects. I know the University of North Carolina is doing that. I'm sure there are other examples that I'm not familiar with. But that's becoming fairly widespread in the U.S. As arguably new function for libraries, but it certainly relates to their ancestral function of being the information storehouse for the university. Okay.
Okay. You'll be up again.